It's a pet or something else that you're passionate about. We all get defensive about the things that we love. And if somebody attacks or doesn't love the things we love, we get really defensive about that. We get passionate. And that person can easily become an adversary and an enemy. They say anything bad about that passion, your sports team, your hobby, the movies you like. If they don't like the things that you like, you can get very passionate and defensive about it. And today, as we continue our series, David's Greatest Hits, looking at some of King David's greatest psalms, we see him write a psalm that is very much like this in his relationship with God. He gets very passionate, he gets very worked up, he gets very excited about his relationship with God, and then he all of a sudden loses his mind over people who don't love God. Just absolutely anybody who's an enemy of God, we'll read it here together and you'll see what I mean. There's this fragile passion that David has in his relationship with God. So if you want to turn with me, it'll also be on your screen, Psalm 139. We have been doing videos of this, but I'm just going to read this one for you. Psalm 139. Psalm 139. I'm on page 1013, if that helps. David writes, "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me. You know when I sit and when I rise. You perceive my thoughts from afar. You discern my going out and my lying down. You are familiar with all my ways. Before a word is on my tongue, you, Lord, know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and you lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me, too lofty for me to attain. Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence? If I go up to the heavens, you are there. If I make my bed in the depths, you are there. If I rise on the wings of the dawn, if I settle on the far side of the sea, even there your hand will guide me. Your right hand will hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like the day, for darkness is as light to you. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame is not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place, when I was woven together in the depths of the earth. Your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. How precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. When I awake, I am still with you." And here's where things turn. "If only God would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you, Lord? And abhor those who are in rebellion against you. I have nothing but hatred for them. I count them my enemies. Search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. See if there is any offensive way in me and lead me in the way everlasting." It's quite the psalm. I mean, the first three verses are beautiful, and they hit your heart, and yeah, that's amazing. And then, boom, David turns around and gets violent. But let's look at this. What's going on? And we've said that the Psalms are really a glimpse into the inner world of David. That sometimes music can cut us in a way and get to our heart in a way that just mere words or just reading something or just hearing about something can't do. But music touches the soul in a deep way. And here we are getting a glimpse into David's inner world, his passion for God, and how that passion turns into zeal against those who don't love him the same way. So he starts in the first stanza. He says, "You know me." Verse 1, he says, "You have searched me, Lord, and you know me." He knows you. Tell the person beside you, he knows you. He does. He knows you. He knows us better than we know ourselves. Isn't it funny that you've lived with yourself every day of your life and you still don't know everything about yourself? I still learn things about myself all the time. I still go, whoa, where did that come from? And it can be a good thing, like, wow, where did that come from? Or it can be a bad thing, like, wow, where did that come from, right? Like, we surprise ourselves all the time. We lie to ourselves all the time. I mean, it's even difficult for me to assess what my true motivations are in any given moment. Am I really motivated in pure ways and righteous ways? Like, oh yes, God, I want to see, you know, people transformed, and I want to see our church grow, and I want to make an impact in the community for you, God, right? For you, God. And so, it's so often for a pastor or for a leader, there's this pride in wanting success for the organization, success for the people, success for the church. And is that to make me feel good, or is that for the glory of God? And I struggle, as we all do. I don't even know my motivations. I don't know myself. But David says, God knows me. God knows my heart. God knows everything about me. And only he is the one who knows me. And isn't this the cry of every heart? Am I known? Does anybody really get me? Does anybody understand my passions? Does anybody understand my fears? Does anybody understand my desires? I mean, we worry about that all the time, and we worry that people won't understand us, and they'll judge us if we do this. We worry that the people we love most will reject us because they'll find something out about us. But he knows us. He knows our hearts. He knows our motivations. And how does this happen? I mean, we believe that God knows everything. We use this theological term. He's omniscient. It means he's all-knowing. But it's more than general omniscience. God, it's not just that God knows everything, but he's actually interested in us. He's actually engaged with us. Not only that, but he designed us. He created us. He formed us. Verse 13 and 14, you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. You see, nobody knows the product like the designer. And nobody knows humans like the creator. God knows us. This verse 14, it's a very famous phrase, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. One commentary said that verse 14 could legitimately be translated, I praise you because I am awesomely wonderful. I mean, that's some humility right there. God, oh man, God, I am amazing. Oh, I'm just incredible. I asked my son, Reuben, once. I said, Reuben, are you adorable? He goes, no, I'm a genius, he says. All right. That's some Funk family humility right there. That's us. I mean, King David was pretty awesome. He killed giants. He was a king. He was handsome. He was wise. He was all these things. But, come on, David. I mean, isn't humility something that we're supposed to practice is, God, I praise you because I'm amazing. The truth is, this isn't actually so much a prideful statement from David as much as it is declaring how amazing God is. Because he's saying, I'm looking at me as a creation. I'm looking at humanity in general. And I say, wow, look at these people. Look what human beings are capable of. Look at the fact that I was able to slay a giant. Look at the athlete who's able to do incredible physical feats. Look at the scientists who are able to dig deeper and deeper into the mysterious mysteries of the universe. Our creativity seems to have no bounds. I mean, we've been to the moon and back. Wow, humans are incredible. That must mean that God is amazing. I mean, if he created us, if he designed us, if he formed us, and we're capable of this, what must he be capable of? That's what David is saying. I'm incredible. Humans are so amazing. But I'm just a creation. You're the creator. You are incredible, and that's why I praise you. He says, you've searched me and know me and are familiar with all of my ways. Uh-oh. He's familiar with all of my ways, all of them. So that means not only has he seen all the things you've done, but he's seen all the things you've thought. He's seen all the things that have been in your heart. He sees the darkness. He sees the sin. He sees all of the struggle. You know all my ways. You know all my impure thoughts. You know all my bad motivations. You know all the things that I'm trying to hide from everybody else. I mean, without a show of hands, who here would say, yeah, there's a couple of things in my life in the past or in the present that I don't want to become public knowledge. God knows about those. He knows every intimate detail about those things. And here's the amazing thing. He loves you. I mean, he knows all the junk, and he loves you. Isn't that amazing? All the stuff that we're afraid that if other people knew about, they'd reject us for, he knows about them, and he welcomes us. Tim Keller once wrote a profound statement. He said, "To be loved but not known is comforting but superficial. To be known and not loved is our greatest fear. But to be fully known and truly loved is what we need more than anything." You see, celebrities have millions of people who love them, but they don't really know them. That's just superficial. And a lot of us fear people who know us the best will reject us based on what they know of us. That's a huge fear. That's horrible. Most of us, probably all of us, have experienced that at some time or another. But Keller is saying God knows you and he loves you. It's not a superficial love based on inadequate evidence, just surface area stuff, but it's based on knowing all the intimate details, and yet his love is still profound. He knows us and loves us, and that's true intimacy. So he knows you. David also says in the second stanza, he says, "You're with me." He says in verse 7, "Where can I go from your spirit? Where can I flee from your presence?" How many people here are people people? Are you a people person? You like being around people? You like groups? You like parties? You come out, your theme song is, "I want to be where the people are," right? Just singing that all day before you get out to church. And yeah. How many people here are more introverts? Yeah, okay. You're in bed Sunday morning. I'll just listen to the podcast. I don't want to see people. No. Yeah, introvert. I mean, believe it or not, I tend to be more of an introvert. I know that's weird considering on a weekly basis I stand before all of you and talk about stuff and tell intimate stories about my life and the type of job I have. But I tend to really like my solitude, my silence. Part of it is just, I mean, I have a people-oriented job, so when I get home, it's nice to just silence. Now, don't get me wrong, I love hanging out with you. I love being here. I love connecting. I love hearing about your life. But at the end of a Sunday morning, and I get home, I'm toast. Like, it just, and so I'm more of an introvert. But those two categories struggle in different ways in their relationship with God, considering the fact that it's a relationship, right? So extroverts have a real hard time just slowing down and just being quiet and getting alone and actually spending some time in prayer and reading the Bible and just listening, right? Extroverts have a very hard time listening, right? You struggle with that. Introverts have a very hard time experiencing the presence of God through community. They have a hard time getting together with people because we experience something special when we experience God through others. We experience people's relationships with God. We see how they see God. We see how they worship him and interact with him, and we experience something special in that. But one way or the other, every human being needs companionship. Introverts will often have just one or two close friends. Extroverts will have hundreds of friends, but very few of them will actually be close. But we're all looking for and needing companionship. And God is the only one who is constantly present, always faithful, always there. He's our closest and most faithful companion. There's no way to get away from him even. We read in Jeremiah 23:24, God says, "Who can hide in secret places so that I cannot see them?" And Jesus promises in Matthew 28:20, he says, "Surely I am with you always to the very end of the age." Always with us. You know, a lot of us here have former relationships. Former friend, a former romance, you know, former family. And these people have left or rejected or whatever it is, but God never gives up, never leaves, never rejects. He says, "I will always, always be with you." David goes deeper in verse 11 and 12. He says, "If I say, surely the darkness will hide me and the light become night around me, even the darkness will not be dark to you. The night will shine like day, for darkness is as light to you." And I think what David is saying here is, even in my darkest times, even when I'm struggling with sin, even when I'm trying to hide from you because I've messed up and I have this disillusionment that you hate me right now, no, you're always there. My darkest corners are still bright as day to you. You are always, always there. You see, we think God is like us. We think that when we sin against him, when we do something he's asked us not to do, when we break his heart, then he walks away. He gives us the silent treatment. He's all upset and he has his arms crossed because that's what we do. But that's not who God is. God isn't us. When we have pushed him away, he continues to pursue us. When we're hiding in the darkness, he's trying to bring in the light. He's always, always there for us. Maybe you're here today and it's your first time in church in a long time, or maybe your first time ever. And maybe one of the things you don't realize is that even before you showed up here, God has been with you. Even before you knew he was present, God was there. Even before you knew he was speaking, he was speaking to you. And sometimes what it takes is for us to go through a little bit of life and to be able to look back and see, wow, God really was there when I thought he was the furthest away. God will always, always be with us. David continues in the third stanza and he says, you're always thinking about me. Verse 17 and 18, he says, how precious to me are your thoughts, God. How vast is the sum of them. Were I to count them, they would outnumber the grains of sand. The context here is clear that David isn't talking about just general thoughts of God. He's talking about God's thoughts for David. God's thoughts about David. That his thoughts about David are more vast than the sand. I mean, have you ever tried counting sand? Even just a handful, like one, two, It's not very easy to do. Those are God's thoughts, and God's thoughts for you are innumerable. Again, sometimes we think God is like us. I'm not always thinking about him. He must not always be thinking about me. Sometimes I forget about him for weeks or for months, but God is constantly thinking about us. He says in verse 16, not only that, but all his days were ordained before they were... Sorry, all the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be. So even before you were born, even as he was knitting you, as this text says, in your mother's womb, God had a plan for your life. He had a plan and he set out in front and he had always been thinking about this plan and he wanted to put something in front of you that would be glorifying to him, that would be a blessing to you, that would change the world and bring you into eternity. He had thought all through that, and he's continuing to think about it. Now, this is amazing because David says, before I did anything, everything was written down. Now, David turned out to be a liar, an adulterer, and a murderer. That was in the book. God had read that book before David's life began. Yet God still said to David, yeah, I'm going to work with you. Yeah, I'm going to make you king. Yeah, I'm going to bless the world through you. Yeah, the Messiah is going to come through your family line. I mean, if you're an employer in this room and you ever got a resume that had all of the future actions of the applicant on it, and you read adulterer, murderer, liar, right? You throw it away. I mean, if you were God, wouldn't you look at David's book and say, adulterer, murderer, liar, why would I make this guy king? Why would I bring the Messiah from his line? Throw it away, try another guy. But aren't you glad God didn't throw you away? Aren't you glad God didn't throw your book away, but instead he continues to think about you, he continues to use you, he continues to want to bless you and love you and be with you, and he knows you, and he wants to take you into eternity. He's always thinking about you. Don't ever think he's got something more important to do or he's too busy to think about you. You are always on his mind. So David here, he's full of faith. He's getting euphoric about God. He's like, oh man, God, you're so amazing. You're so incredible. You're always thinking about me. You're with me. You know me. You made me. You're amazing. But there's one thing I don't get. There's one thing I don't really understand, God. It really makes no sense to me. Verse 19, if only you, God, would slay the wicked. I mean, you're with me. You're thinking about me, you love me, all these things. But God, why aren't you dealing with evil? Like, God, there's all these people who say horrible things about you. There's all these people who are my adversaries. There's all these people who are doing bad things. He says, if only you, God, would slay the wicked. Away from me, you who are bloodthirsty. They speak of you with evil intent. Your adversaries misuse your name. Do I not hate those who hate you? Lord, and abhor those who are in rebellion against you. I have nothing but hatred for you. I count them my enemies. I mean, David's here like, you love me, you're with me, you're thinking about me, you know me. Let's kill all the bad guys, God. Let's get them. I mean, just say the word, I'm with you. David here is getting impatient with the patience of God. He's saying, there's all these things I love about you, God, but I just don't get this. I still have these doubts and questions. And then he turns this lovely, amazing song into heavy metal, Metallica, and he's just like, hey, imagine this, because this is a song that would have been sung in the worship gathering. So you can imagine saying, God, you love us. You're with us, God. We hate everyone who hates you, God. Oh, Jesus. Slay the wicked, God. I mean, like, that's what this song is. Can you imagine singing that today? I mean, we've got to get some songwriters on this. Like, it's in the Bible. But I love this because this is so honest. Isn't this human nature? God, I like these things, but what about this? Why haven't you done anything about this? Now, during your Christian life, you're going to slide back and forth on the continuum of faith and doubt. There's going to be some days where you're just full of faith, like, God, you're with me. I know it. Oh, your works are amazing. You just do incredible things. And other days, your life is going to be full of doubt. God, I just don't get it. Why are bad things happening to good people? Why do the innocent suffer? Why do the bad guys seem to win? Why am I depressed? Why am I still sick? I don't get it, God. We're going to slide back and forth. And I think David, though subtle, he actually shares with us some ways in which he deals with his own doubts and unanswered questions. In this psalm, and I mean, he's totally honest with it, and he just says, God, these are the things I struggle with. But two ways that David has used, even in this psalm, to deal with his unanswered questions. First of all, he praised God for what he does do before complaining about what he doesn't do. He spent three stanzas praising God for how amazing he is, how he's with them, how he loves them, how he knows them, before he came to God and said, hey, but you know what? There's something I still don't get. See, and sometimes we allow our doubts to become the forefront of our minds. We allow the one thing or the two things that we don't quite get to overwhelm all the things that we know and understand and love about God, and they become the most primary attributes of our relationship with him. But David prioritizes the things he loves about God and truly knows about God before his doubts. Now, the Apostle Paul wrote to the church in Philippi, and there was some anxiety happening in the church. They had some issues going on. There was strife. And one of the practical tools he encouraged them to use was, guess what? Their brain. He said, I want you guys to think a certain way. Not to bury thoughts, but to prioritize certain ones. Not to bury doubts, but prioritize faith. He says in Philippians 4:8, this is what I want you to think about. Whatever is true, whatever is noble, whatever is right, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is admirable, if anything is excellent or praiseworthy, think about such things. He's not telling them to bury their doubts, absolutely not. What he's telling them is to meditate on the good things they know about God. He's telling them, actually, to think about the doctrines of the faith. What do we know about God's love for us? Why did Jesus come to earth and incarnate as a human being? What were his teachings and the hallmarks of his life? What does the cross accomplish? And if we have doubts and anxieties, if we spend a little bit of our mental energy meditating on those truths, the things that are true, noble, trustworthy, it may actually reorient our doubts. It may reorient our anxieties, put them in their proper place in the order of thoughts, and help even potentially give us some answers. So David spends his time praising God for the things he loves about him before complaining. He says in verse 23, search me, God, and know my heart. Test me and know my anxious thoughts. Where are these anxieties coming from? Where are these emotions coming from? Let's put them in their place. The second strategy David uses to deal with his anxieties and his unanswered questions is he first deals with the evil inside. I mean, he had this question about, God, why don't you deal with evil? Why don't you deal with wicked people? But David actually turned toward himself. In verse 24, he said, see if there's any offensive way in me. Is there anything in me that needs to be dealt with, God? See, one way that doubts come is when we're actually on the wrong track, and then we misinterpret God because we're walking in the wrong direction, and we've allowed evil influences in our life, and we've walked in the wrong way, and so God doesn't make sense. We begin to call good evil and evil good, and so we have doubts. And David says, you know what? I need to examine my own life. I need God's help to examine me to see if I'm in the right direction. One of the misconceptions we have is that evil is a thing that's out there, and that it's over there, and if we deal with that problem, everything will be better. If you watch any political debate, you see this. They're the bad guys. We're the good guys. They're messing everything up, or they're going to mess everything up. We will do everything perfectly right, and it'll be amazing. Right? That's pretty much the conversation, and that's human nature. Evil is out there. I mean, there's nothing wrong in here. It's out there. If we fix that, everything will be okay. But David says, no, no, no. There's a very good chance that there's some evil going on in here too. N.T. Wright says, the line between good and evil is never simply between us and them. The line between good and evil runs through each one of us. It begins in my heart. David realized something very important. He couldn't complain about evil out there until he first addressed the evil in here, until he first dealt with what was in his own heart. So maybe I need to back off a minute from judging God and begin to examine my own heart and my own actions first. David says, search me. See if there's an offensive way in me. And if we want him to deal with evil, he has to deal with our heart. And if David's asking God to kill all the bad guys, we might be on the hit list. And thankfully, as we talked about at communion time, it wasn't us who died. It was the Lamb. The Lamb was slain for our benefit so that we were passed over. And Jesus comes as the Lamb of the world. And he took the evil from my heart and put it in his own. And he died, and with him, the evil in my heart and the sin in my life died as well. It was buried with him, never to return. But he came back to offer new life. That's the new covenant, the new way of living with God. You know, all of us, make sure that he looks inside with God's help to examine the issues of his own heart. And he begins to meditate on all the things he knows about God, and he allows those thoughts to be primary while the secondary thoughts are put in their place, not buried, but put in their place. And we too can follow suit, and we can say, as David began and ended the psalm, he says, search me, search me. Search me, God. See, David had this life of incredible intimacy with God. Even as a young boy, he just had this connection with God that was so powerful and so amazing. And at one point, he was called a man after God's own heart. But he still wanted more of him. He still wanted more of God, and he still wanted God to continue to take all the stuff out of his life that would get in the way of getting more of God. It would get in the way of knowing him more. I mean, God knows us, but I want to know him more. God's always with me, but I want to experience his presence more. God's always thinking about me, but I want my thoughts to change as well, to think God thoughts. So how can I do that? How can I do that? How can I live that life and that intimacy with him? The psalm ends, see if there's any offensive way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting. Lead me in the way everlasting. Jesus comes, he says, I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. And no one comes to the Father except through me. Early Christians just called themselves followers of the way. The way is not a list of do's and don'ts. The way is not a religion. The way is a person, Jesus Christ. And it's in following him, it's in receiving him as Lord and Savior, that life gets transformed. Thoughts change. Heart motivations are never the same. So whether it's the first time today that you say, I want to follow the way, or whether it's, you know what, I like David, I feel like I've got a good relationship with God, but I just want more. I want deeper. I want fresh. I want a new outpouring. I want him to help me work through the issues that I'm dealing with.